It's been a few weeks since we were in this book, so I'm glad to be able to come back to it. And if you remember, we have already looked at the first five verses of this chapter. And so we're looking from verse 6 to the end of the chapter, and that's why I call it the four trumpets. Remember that I'm doing a series here going through the book of Revelation, basically doing one message per chapter, which is a lot to do, but because of the way this book is laid out, we can look at groups of things that are taking place or will take place yet in the future. And let me remind you that, of course, this book is about the future. These are things that have not happened yet and will happen. And just in preparing this message tonight on these trumpet judgments, even the first four and the next three are worse than these, but the first four remind us of terrible things that are going to happen, cataclysmic things that are going to happen on this earth. And we look around us today, and we are troubled by a lot of things we see. We see how one little bacteria can bring the world to its knees, can't it? Just in a way that all over the world, people are having to stop businesses and stop what they do and stay inside, and whether it's church or business or whatever cannot happen. So we can see how tragedies can affect a whole world, especially these days, where communication is instant and travel is constant all over the world. And when we read what's going to happen in the future, where God himself will bring these things on the world for specific reasons, we can see what tragedy this will bring over the whole world. And so we look at verse 6, and remember it says, "The seven angels which had the seven trumpets prepared them to sound." Well, we have seen these seven angels back in verse 2, where John says, "I saw these seven angels, and they were given seven trumpets." And remember that we call them the presence angels. That is, these angels that are in the presence of the throne, in the presence of God, waiting to do his bidding at a certain time. And so we've seen them as that. And then we're going to see the first four. You notice in chapter 8 that verse 12 is the fourth angel. And then we stop there, and chapter 9 begins the fifth. But we don't get to the seventh angel until chapter 11, verse 15. So these last three that are going to be called woes, because they're even worse than the first four, are the expression or the explanation of them is drawn out a lot longer. I want to tell you about a couple guys that I'm going to quote from tonight. You know, when I do this study, I've got a whole shelf of commentaries on Revelation, because I've always loved prophecy and I love to study the book of Revelation. And I've got all kinds of guys, some that you'd agree with, some that you wouldn't, some that are old, some that are new, contemporary, and so forth. And it's kind of interesting to me to see how they interact even with one another. It's good for us. I'm going to quote Henry Morris, I think, three different times tonight. And I do that, it's kind of interesting, because Morris has, I don't know if you know that name, Henry Morris, but Henry Morris has a commentary on Genesis because he was highly involved in the creationism movement, and then he has a commentary on Revelation. And both of these books, the beginning and the end, have to do with great cataclysmic things that happen to the earth. And of course, he was highly interested in that. Henry Morris received a B.S. in civil engineering from Rice, a M.A. in hydraulics from the University of Minnesota, a Ph.D. in hydraulic engineering from the University of Minnesota, and was professor of civil engineering at Virginia Tech for years and years. And in 1961, he and John Whitcomb wrote a book called The Genesis Flood. That book brought into modern time and discussion the whole movement about creation. As a matter of fact, Even Ken Ham wouldn't be what he is today, or wouldn't have gotten his start in this movement had it not been for Henry Morris and John Whitcomb. And then in 1972, they began a school, which is the Institute for Creation Research, ICR, still puts out a magazine and speakers all over the world. And then after that, though he wrote many other books, he wrote these two commentaries, which I like to read. And I do because here's a guy that understands as much as anybody how the earth physically is put together. And when things like the Genesis flood happened, or even the Tower of Babel and the separation of the continents and things like that, he has great perspective on this because not only is he an engineer and a geologist, but he's a theologian. And by the way, both Whitcomb and Morris were good dispensationalists in understanding the layout of the Bible as well. As a matter of fact, I'm not the only one that enjoys these, because as I read then Charles Ryrie's commentary on Revelation, guess who he's quoting? He's quoting Henry Morris. And I read John MacArthur's commentary on Revelation, and guess who he's quoting? He's quoting Henry Morris. So a lot of guys appreciate Morris's, and he's with the Lord now, of course, but a lot of guys appreciate his view on what do these things mean when these great cataclysmic things happen. And so I like him. Now, another guy that I like is Joseph Seiss, and he lived from 1823 to 1904, so he's been gone for a while. But he was an early dispensationalist, a man that was a premillennialist, but understood God's plan of the ages, and I appreciate his volumes also. Now, Morris says this when he's talking about these seven angels. He says, "The archangels, signaling as it were a great military advance by the armies of heaven when the trumpets blow, will thereby trigger the most tremendous physical upheavals experienced since the great flood." Now also, it's interesting as we look at these four trumpet judgments that you begin to also see people who allegorize these things or spiritualize them. You know what I mean when I say that, right? There are those who read the book of Revelation and say, it's already over. It happened in the first century. Or some say, it happened in the last 2,000 years over church history. All of these things are done. Well, they have spiritualized these things or allegorized them. That is, they don't take it literally. They take these as symbols of other things. And I've read a few guys who do that. I like what old Joseph Seiss said. He by the way, was a Moravian in his church life. But he said, "I take the language as it stands." Now, here's a guy from 200 years ago. "I take the language as it stands. This book does not give things veiled, but unveiled. It is the apocalypse, the uncovering. The results here described are heralded by the sound of a trumpet. What is published by a trumpet is no longer a secret." And so what he's saying is God will say what it is. And when we read the book of Revelation, we can take it for what it is. We're going to look at that tonight. You know, there are, I think, two errors, kind of polar errors, in interpreting prophecy. And one is to allegorize everything so that it's fulfilled now. You might look at these trumpets and you see, the earth, the third part of the trees being burned up and the grass being burned up. And you might say, well, see, that's a sign of the great famines and things that we've had going on the earth during the church age. That would be allegorizing that. Well, the other, I think, error in interpreting prophecy, and many times premillennialists do this, is putting everything literal on a time frame so that we say the Lord is coming at this time. And because we see a certain thing happening in the world right now, that means that Jesus will come before we all die or something like that. Or set a date, and that he will. And there have been many date setters, especially in the 20th century. So we don't want to make either error to the left side or to the far right side, all right? And so before we look at our outline, which is on your bulletin, I'm going to give you 8 principles for interpreting the book of Revelation just real fast. Number one, these are God's words. They will happen. I mean, we have to have confidence in that. When we read this book, whether you understand it all or not, whether you think, boy, that is fantastic, it is God's word. It's just as inspired as John 3:16. This will happen. Number two, Revelation chapter 4 to the end of the book, to chapter 22, is yet in the future. So everything that we're reading about here in chapter 8 and all of these chapters hasn't happened yet and is not happening now. Number three, the church age ends with the rapture, which has to take place before the rest of these things happen. And so you can say to yourself, if I'm still on this earth, Revelation hasn't happened yet. Because the rapture will happen, and we will be gone, and then chapter 4 to chapter 22 will begin to take place. And number four, therefore, our current world situation is not the fulfillment of Revelation, that is, of Revelation 4 through 22. As much as we look around and we see things that to us say, boy, that could make, you know, that could be the Antichrist. That could be something the Antichrist uses. But it isn't yet. Even the pandemic that we're all suffering under and have to do all of these things, this isn't described in the book of Revelation. Other than in the age of grace, there's going to be a lot of trouble and heartache, and we're going to have to suffer through a lot of it. And this is one of them. Number five, the best we can do or see is a similar foreshadowing that might indicate the nearness of things. In other words, if a great apostasy is happening in the world and things are getting worse and worse and people are turning away from God more than ever, and we see even how one man, an Antichrist, could rule the world if he wanted to, then we might say, you know, I think this is the end is closer than we think. And I think that's worth saying. We can see parallels, but those are only suppositions. You know, I confess that I like to do the what ifs. That is, I like to say, what if the European Union will be the 10-nation confederation that Daniel in Revelation spoke about? What if? Well, we can think that way. And what if the Antichrist could come out of one of those 10 nations even today? And what if the Roman Catholic Church would fall in a day? How would it look today? Who would it be? What would happen? Well, you can say what if. I made the mistake one time of doing that in a sermon. And I had a fella in the church who was a seminary professor, and he said to me afterwards, "You're crazy, you know what?" And he said, and he never came back to church. So we have to be careful about making our what ifs sound as if we are saying this is what's happening. We don't know. I've said before, really, if I lived in the 1930s Germany, who would not have thought that Hitler would be the Antichrist? I mean, if you lived at that time and suffered under that regime, that's what you would be thinking. But look, he wasn't. It didn't happen. And we've gone far beyond that. Worse things will happen than that yet in the future. And number seven, the truth is we are nearer to the end than we've ever been before, right? I mean, you have to say that. More time has gone by and the rapture still hasn't taken place. We're closer to it than we were yesterday or that we were 1,000 years ago. And lastly, number eight, when it happens, it will be fast. Things will happen suddenly. When the rapture takes place, we are gone. And immediately these things of Revelation begin to happen one right after another. And all of this happens within a 7-year period. Within 3.5 years after the rapture, the Antichrist will literally rule the world, and you won't be able to even go to the store and buy anything without his mark on your body. 3.5 years. You know, when I was a kid and people used to preach about that, we'd talk about, I wonder how that can happen. What will the mark of the beast look like? You know, how? And nowadays, I think there's 100 ways he could do that. Big deal, you know. Of course he can do that. We can almost do it today, you know. So those are some things we have to think about and know. Let's go to our outline, and you have that, again, in your bulletin, just these four things. But what this outline does show you is, in these four judgments, as they come upon the earth, God will bring devastation to, number one, the vegetation of the earth, which is bad enough. Secondly, on the salt water, the seas of the earth. Thirdly, on the fresh water of the earth. And lastly, even on the heavenlies, that is the sun, moon, and stars. And so God is bringing catastrophic things upon these parts of the world. So we begin in verse 7. The first angel sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled with blood, and they were cast upon the earth. And the third part of trees was burnt up, and all green grass was burnt up. Let me first... tell you how the allegorists would take this, just so that you can see. They would say that this trumpet in verse 7, this first trumpet, is a picture of how God has been chastening the world for the last 2,000 years. Hail refers to judgment. We shouldn't look for real hail coming out of the sky, but rather it's a picture of when God judged, and God has judged the world in many ways, by wars and by famines and so forth. The fire is a symbol of wrath. And so where we see fire, we see that God's wrath has come upon the earth. Blood refers to death, and so many people have died. Trees refer to men, and grass refers to men's glory. Matter of fact, two guys that I like to read otherwise went this direction, and I'm scratching my head saying, really? You're saying that? And I wrote down in my notes, if it doesn't mean what it says, we have no idea what it is. I mean, one idea is that these four trumpets are referring to natural disasters, floods, hurricanes, earthquakes, tsunamis, and all of those kinds of things. Or they could refer to the wars of the world, not only of the 20th century, but all the way back for 2,000 years. God has brought death and blood upon the earth. Or it could refer to COVID-19, couldn't it? I mean, if that's the way you're going to look at it, you could say, well, look at all the people who are dying, and look at the devastation it's bringing, and God's judgment on the earth. And so, therefore, the first trumpet judgment is pictures COVID-19. If you're an allegorist and you take the Bible that way, but rather I would take it even as Moses took it when he went before Pharaoh. If you go back and read very similar words in the book of Exodus, everything that Moses said would happen happened exactly as he said. For example, Exodus 9, here he is saying, as you exalt yourself against my people, here's Moses before Pharaoh, in that you will not let them go, behold, tomorrow about this time I will cause heavy hail to rain down, such as has not been in Egypt since the founding until now. And let me ask you, did real hail fall from heaven? Well, if the Bible's true, it did. It wasn't some allegorous way of referring to judgment. Real hail came from heaven, and real water turned into real blood. And so if God can do it then, do you think he can do it in the future? And if he could do it in one little land called Egypt, he can do it anywhere or everywhere on the earth if he wants to. Now, hail and fire and blood, it is kind of an odd way to look at it, because some literalists think that along with the hail will be lightning and maybe fire and somehow blood actually falling on the earth. Other take this as there's been such a thing as a blood rain before, where there has been both with the snow or with the rain a red color of water or snow. Maybe it is. And others take this to be, as a matter of fact, Henry Morris even said that this may be like the tail of a comet. When Halley's Comet went across the sky, you could see the tail of it for miles and miles. And if that was falling upon the earth, it would be in great hail and so forth. And so most commentators take it as that then it will be a bloody mess when all of that hits people on the earth and hits the animals and the livestock and so forth. It will be mixed with blood. The fact is, there will be such a hail, and it will come on the earth. Now, a third part of the trees. You know how important the trees are to the earth, right? You know how important the vegetation is to the earth. And so here, a third part of the trees was burnt up, and all green grass was burnt up because of this hail and fire. Can you imagine such a thing? I mean, we see it in one locale, or we see it in one region or something, but imagine this happening. By the way, keep your eye open for the expression one-third in these four judgments, because God will bring this upon one-third of the earth in many different ways. And so God is gradually bringing his judgments on the earth at this time. And so that will happen. And by the way, Ezekiel has a prophecy where Ezekiel in chapter 5, what happened in Ezekiel 5 is God told him to get a haircut and to take his hair and put a third of it over here and a third of it over here and a third of it over here. And that was so that he could preach to the people that God's judgment is coming in the future, and he will do a third and a third and a third. And so Ezekiel 5 says, one third of you shall die of the pestilence and be consumed with famine in your midst. One third shall fall by the sword all around you, and I will scatter another third to the winds, and I will draw out a sword after them. And so this expression of one third upon the world is prophesied in many different places. So here's the first judgment upon the vegetation. And when the trees die and the grass dies, folks, you can't imagine what that will do to the earth's ecosystem. Second, trumpet judgment in verses 8 and 9 is upon the sea itself. The second angel sounded, and as it were, in the old version, or like in the new, as it were a great mountain burning with fire was cast into the sea, and the third part, there's the third again, of the sea became blood. And the third part of the creatures which were in the sea and had life, literally had souls, died, and the third part of the ships were destroyed. You see how God is gradually bringing the judgment on the earth. Now, the allegorists would say, well, the great mountain refers to the governments of the world, because there are symbols in the Bible about mountains being governments. And the sea would be Rome, and the ships would be the church. Can you imagine that? Can you see that? Can't you see that in that text? That's what happens if you make this allegory. But rather, there is something unique here, and that is we have a symbol called a simile. An allegory or a simile, and it is with the words as it were, or in the other version, like a great mountain, meaning it may not be a mountain that comes out of the sky and hits the salt water, but it will be something like a mountain. Now, I point that out to you because if you say to somebody sometime, you know, I just take the Bible literally, and they scoff at you and say, how can you take these things literally as if all of these things will literally happen? Well, when we say we take the Bible literally, it also means we understand that there are symbols in the Bible, and there are allegories in the Bible, and there are similes and metaphors in the Bible, but it tells us when those things appear. And here, it tells us. So Let me quote Henry Morris again about what he says about this verse. It is probably not an actual mountain, say the crest of an exploding volcano, for example, or John would have recognized it as such. He said instead it is like a great mountain, a simile. When you say like or as, you're making a simile in English, something that's similar to that. So he says, a mighty mass of rock hurling toward the earth, surrounded by combustible gases which ignite as they enter the atmosphere, steered earthward by the angelic host of heaven, seems the most likely physical explanation accessible to us at this time. So notice that he takes the symbol, but it's very literal. That is, there will be some great mass coming out of the sky, and it will hit the waters of the earth, and these things will happen. So we can take it literally, but the word mountain, John says, it's like a mountain. I mean, I looked at it, I wasn't sure what that was coming out of heaven like that. It looked to me like a big mountain, and that's fair enough to say, and the Holy Spirit inspired him to say it that way. Well, some say a large asteroid, a meteor type of thing, perhaps even a comet that hits the earth. It could be. We don't know. But notice, one-third of the sea becomes blood. One-third of sea life dies. And one-third of the ships are destroyed. So God is bringing this judgment. I think it could be that the water actually turns to blood. Others say it's blood red, and God brings this poison to the salt water and kills the life in the ocean. Either way, it would be a devastating thing. But I think, in Egypt, the water actually turned to blood and it smelled. The one-third of the sea life died, and the word life there in verse 9 is the word suke or soul. Do you know that fish have souls? You didn't know that, did you? But fish do not have eternal souls, but they have life. And whatever has life and swims around or breathes air or flies in the sky or walks on the earth has life, and that can be called soul. But those souls die and never live again. They are not souls made in God's image. You are a soul made in God's image, and therefore your soul will live eternally. It's a difference here. Now, also, it's interesting that a third of the ships are destroyed. So where is that, and how does that happen? I don't know. But obviously, if this kind of thing happens to the sea, I don't want to be sailing my ship where this thing hits the water. Or some say, imagine the tsunami that this will create across the Pacific Ocean or across the Atlantic Ocean or wherever this thing hits, and the ships in the water and in the docks and everything would be destroyed, because you could never imagine a tsunami that big that's going to be created by this thing that hits the earth. Well, have we ever seen anything like that? No, we really haven't. We've never seen such catastrophic things hitting the earth. Well, if you lived, I guess, in Noah's day, you would have never thought that was going to happen either, could you? And yet God made it happen. And so in the future, God's going to make these kinds of things happen. Let's go to the third one, and that is the third trumpet that sounds in verse 10 and 11. The third angel sounded, and there fell a great star from heaven, burning again as it were a lamp. It's not a lamp, but it's on fire like a lamp would be on fire. But it is a star of some kind that falls, and it fell upon, again, the third part, but this time of fresh water, of rivers and fountains of water. And John, through inspiration, gives us the name of this star, and that is Wormwood. Well, this great star, again, we can take literally, it's another great mass that is coming out of the sky. you know, if you see a shooting star, it's not really a star, is it? It's a meteor or something that is burning up as it comes through the atmosphere of the earth. We've had a lot of those lately. Have you been outside at night and seen the shooting stars lately? I saw one the other morning, and I'm telling you, I thought maybe a lightning bug went right across my face and lit up in front of me. I mean, this thing was the biggest flame I ever saw. But the way it went and as fast as it went, it had to be a shooting star. I've never seen anything so bright. Well, God can bring something like that to the earth like this, and he calls it wormwood. Now, wormwood is a word that appears in the Bible often, and wormwood is actually a shrub that grew in the Holy Lands. But from this shrub called wormwood, they made poison from it, or a very intoxicating liquor type of thing that would be very dangerous. In Jeremiah 9:15, for example, "Therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I will feed them, even this people, with wormwood, and give them water of gall to drink." And so to drink the liquid that they made, that they extracted from this plant, could be called hemlock, as some people translate it. Could be called gall here in Jeremiah, meaning this, that this star that comes out of heaven and hits the fresh water of the earth will turn the fresh water poisonous to bitterness so that you can't drink it. Now notice what God is doing here. Already a third of the salt water is turned to blood. And now a third of the fresh water? We have enough problems with fresh water on this earth right now the way it is, don't we? And God will make it poisonous so that nobody can use it? What a plague that will be. And so again, a third of the rivers, a third of the fountains, the freshwater springs and so forth, and this time many people died. Yes, many people will die. We've already seen back in chapter 6 that a third of the people died, and now many people will die, and we'll see great death even farther on in this book. So the God's judgment upon the fresh water, folks, to this point will bring, if you think the world is mixed up because of the coronavirus, think of what will happen when these things have struck on the earth in quick succession. Maybe these are weeks apart. Maybe they're months apart. They're not very far apart. This is just one third of the judgments coming in the 7-year period, and it looks like they're coming at least these four, one right after the other. Imagine what will happen to the economy of this earth, what will happen to the people of this earth, and the governments will say, whoa, we've got to do this, we've got to do that, when these things happen. The amazing thing that will come. Well, the fourth judgment in verse 12 is God's judgment on, I call the heavenlies, meaning the sun, moon, and stars. He says, "The fourth angel sounded, and the third part of the sun was smitten, the third part of the moon, and the third part of the stars, so that the third part of them was darkened, and the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise." Well, the allegorists say this is simply the disruption of governments, you know, that governments will begin to fall apart. That's not what it says here. It says the sun, moon, and the stars will be affected. Some take this to be a great eclipse. John Walvoord, for example, a good commentator on the book of Revelation, sees maybe volcanic action that happens because of the other plagues and then the darkening of the sun. And if the sun is darkened, the moon will be darkened because of an eclipse type of an effect. But others see this, that the actual lumens of the sun will be lessened, and the sun will not shine as bright as it did before. Now, can you imagine that? And when you start to talk like that, people are really going to say you're crazy. But hey, if you talk about Joshua's long day in the Old Testament where God made the sun stand still for a whole day, people say you're crazy too. But that happened. How can God stop the rotation of things around the sun and not mess everything up? How can he do that? Well, I'll tell you how. He created it. He can change it. He made it happen instantly. He can change it instantly. That's God. And no wonder people will say, this is the day of God's wrath, and who can abide God's wrath when it comes? May I read to you what Henry Morris says here for the last time? He says the simplest explanation of all this, simplest, he says, in the sense of economy of explanation, not of scientific understanding, which we have none of at this time, is that somehow the visible luminaries in the heavens for a time, maybe a day, maybe several days, slow down their internal reactions in such a way as to reduce their power output by a factor of 1/3. The day and night, as a result, are only 2/3 as bright as normal, even though the skies are completely clear of haze or anything else to obscure the light. Another paragraph later, he says, since solar physicists even yet do not really comprehend either the full nature of gravitational processes or of solar radiation, do understand such things, or at least God does, and he can instruct them, we are safe in assuming God's hosts are quite capable of accomplishing this tremendous hiatus in the normal operation of all the heavenly bodies. In other words, he said just what I said a few minutes ago, and that is, if God can create these things and say, and he created the stars also, and then billions and trillions of stars are created, then he can do anything he wants with them, the sun or the earth or anything else, or the moon. So when these things happen, what are people going to say? Who shall be able, look back at chapter 6 and verse 17. They will say, for the great day of his wrath is come, and who shall be able to stand? What can we do before a God like this? Well, those things are going to happen. And by the way, there are many references in the Old Testament to the sun, moon, and stars being darkened. I have Ezekiel chapter 32, Joel chapter 2 and chapter 3, Amos chapter 9. There are many references to the tribulation period when the sun will not shine as it has before. Imagine what that will do to the earth. But God can do it if he wants. Now, somebody has noticed that in all of these judgments, whether it's the seals, the trumpets, and then later the bowl judgments, that the first four of the judgments seem to fall upon nature and upon the earth itself, whereas the second three of the judgments fall upon human beings. And that's exactly what we're going to see here. So notice as we finish the chapter in verse 13, behold, I heard another angel, an angel flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, woe, woe, and woe to the inhabitants of the earth by reason of the other voices of the trumpet of the three angels which are yet to sound. And we call these not only the last three trumpet judgments, but we call them the three woes that come on the earth because they will come upon human beings. And so here's the warning of these things happening. You know, I did have this thought. Boy, we take God's good green earth for granted, don't we? I mean, you woke up this morning and the sun came up. And it's August, so it was bright and sunny. Well, it was a little rainy today. But the rain comes, we take that for granted. Fresh water coming from the clouds back into the streams and so forth. The green grass, I mowed my grass yesterday, and I'm talking about how come this stuff is growing so much in August? You know, we're not supposed to have to mow so much. We take it all for granted. Imagine a time when you can't take these things for granted. What a time of tribulation that will be on the earth, and it's coming. I'll end with John Walvoord's words where he says, fearful as these judgments are, They are only the beginning of God's dealings with the earth. And as indicated in the special announcement, which we just read, three great woes are still to fall. Though it is difficult in this day of grace to imagine such catastrophic judgments, the Word of God is plain, and men are called everywhere to avail themselves of grace before it's too late. And isn't that what we do with the gospel? We know these things are coming. We know that when the rapture happens, then our preaching is done. And the Holy Spirit goes with us, and people will be catapulted into this time of judgment. Now is the age of grace. Now is the accepted time. This is God's day of patience and long-suffering with people. And that is why today is a day of the gospel. Today is a day to get ready for these things, because we know they're coming. All right, stand with me, if you will, as we think about these things. We'll sing a song in a minute, and we'll let God speak to our hearts. Father, thank you for reminding us again of what's yet to come. It's in your word. We read it. Sometimes we don't stop and contemplate all the terrible things that will happen, your judgment upon the sins of this world. Father, help us not only to believe it, that it's coming, but to act upon it, and to be good witnesses and spreaders of the gospel, good people that pray for sinners. Help us, Father, to do our stewardship in the day in which we live, because we know the truth of your word. Speak to our hearts in the way that we need. Encourage us in the way that we need. We'll thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. Kent, come.